If you like your beer, you might be just fine with getting it from a bottle or tap, but maybe you would also like to have some control over what comes out of that bottle or tap. In that case, homebrewing might be for you. Many, many people do homebrew beer, and our first guest this hour is full of advice for them in his book, Mastering Homebrew, The Complete Guide to Brewing Delicious Beer. Randy Mosher is a serial brewer and a serial writer about homebrewing, considered a beer expert. He's a member of the faculty of the Siebel Institute, America's oldest brewing school. His other books are Brewer's Companion, Radical Brewing, and Tasting Beer. Randy Mosher, welcome to The Exchange.
Thanks, Jeff. Thanks for having me on.
So what could you say in this book that you had not said in the others?
Well, this was, book was really designed as a start-to-finish homebrewing book, whereas my other books were maybe a little more specialized in one particular point of view or another, or tasting beer, of course, that's about tasting, not brewing. So I wanted to have a book that was start-to-finish, would walk you through the steps from your very first brew all the way up to really mastering the recipe process, kind of owning the recipe process, and understanding flavor. And that's the real focus of the book that sort of differentiates it from a lot of the other books out there. It's very much oriented around the point of view of owning that recipe process and really being in control of it and being able to make anything you want from a flavor standpoint.
I have to hand it to you. If you want to get deeply into the science in the book, the tables are there for you. If you want to just make a halfway decent tasting beer, there are lots of broader diagrams with pictures and stuff that make it easy for the people who want to approach it on that level. So you really made it accessible for lots of people.
It's a right brain, left brain activity. I think a lot of people in the computer sciences and engineering are drawn to it because they get to play artist and be creative in it, that they don't always have those opportunities in their work. Whereas people like me who kind of come from an art background are drawn to the science and technology aspect of it. So if you're doing it well, you're using both parts of your brain, both the analytical and the creative, because you can't do it with just one.
Randy, have there been some developments in recent years, either in flavor varieties or techniques, that have changed the home brewing game a bit?
Well, a little bit, maybe. Certainly there are a lot more ingredients available now than there used to be. I started brewing in the mid-80s, and there was very little information and very little ingredients. And the world of hops has changed dramatically. Even in the last 10 years, there's been an enormous number of new varieties. And you see them on the shelves in the beer aisles where people are highlighting individual hops like Mosaic or Amarillo or Citra. And those have become very, very popular. So there's a lot more options. And then just the general supply chain in terms of homebrew supply shops. The one that I go to here in Chicago, I think they have about 60 or 70 different kinds of malts and other grains available. So you have a huge variety to choose from. And the same is true of yeast. You can get a yeast that is the yeast that's used at many of the famous breweries in Belgium or England, for example, or you just have enormous amount of choice and, of course, a lot of great information now, too. So it's really exploded from that point of view. And I think the other thing that's going on right now is that when I started brewing, there was nothing that was called the maker culture, but now we have that whole idea that's sort of driven by millennials who want to get their hands on things and they want to control things. They want to roast their own coffee. They want to make pickles and kombucha, and they want to brew beer and do woodworking and welding and steampunk art and whatever. So it's all part of that same idea, really kind of started in the 60s and 70s with my generation's movement in that direction, and now we've got the second wave that's coming on really strong. It's very exciting to see.
And as you point out in the book, it seems like every community has a club or an association, a support group, if you want to call it that, for people who want to compare notes on homebrewing.
Yeah, homebrew clubs. I mean, brewing is famous both on the amateur and professional level as being very socially oriented and very helpful and community-minded. So the homebrew clubs, it's really kind of where I started making connections and learning about beer, and was fortunate enough to hook up with some great clubs in Texas and Washington, D.C. and Los Angeles. And then, of course, in my own home of Chicago, I worked with the Chicago Beer Society for quite a number of years and helped that club along. We actually have a club now in Chicago area that has their own clubhouse. So you don't have to brew at home. You can actually go to the clubhouse and brew on the systems of the club.
Really? Wow.
Yeah, so it's a very social thing. It's a new development. The club is called Chaos. And they're younger people, and they are really very social and very ambitious with what they're doing. So it's really cool to see a lot of activity like that.
I was a little surprised in a preface to the book that Jimmy Carter gets some credit here. What did he do to help the homebrew craze?
Well, after Prohibition, when they rewrote the laws, they allowed the brewing of homemade wine. But for whatever reason, they just didn't bother or didn't think to mention homebrewed beer. And so it was a little bit of a glitch in the law. I don't think it was ever intentional, but people didn't really mind brewing. There wasn't any risk in that, but people were reluctant to open businesses like homebrew shops because technically they were selling ingredients that were used for a purpose that was not totally legal. Hmm. So that was 1976. So that really allowed the movement to get started and people to come out of the shadows and suppliers to start opening up and working with their customers and creating these little communities.
For the people afraid to try because homebrewing sounds messy or expensive or hard to get it right, what's the quick pitch on that?
The pitch is if you can make a batch of lasagna, you can make a batch of beer.
Oh,
that
it is very quick.
Yeah, so, I mean, you go to, find your local homebrew shop, walk in there, tell them what kind of beer you like, and say, I want to get started. And somewhere between $100 and $200, you should be able to get up and rolling.
And the book can help, too. It's called Mastering Homebrew, The Complete Guide to Brewing Delicious Beer. It is the work of Randy Mosher, who's our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. We'll come back and talk more with Randy and take your phone calls and emails when we return to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 20. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thanks for listening. We're talking about homebrewing beer with Randy Mosher, who has written several books on the topic. His latest is called Mastering Homebrew, The Complete Guide to Brewing Delicious Beer. As Randy just told us, if you can make a batch of lasagna, you can make a batch of beer. Join us at 800-838-3760 by phone with questions, comments, or your own stories about brewing. And you can also join us by email at jx@jeffnet.org. There is a quick start guide. I pointed out the fact that the book is written on a couple of different levels. You can be making beer by page 16, basically. What are some of the very basic things you'll need to get started, Randy?
You need a big pot to put on the stove, and you need a stove. A lot of people, once they really get into the hobby, they start with a propane burner, like a turkey fryer type of burner, and brew out in their garages. But you need a thermometer. You need an instrument called a hydrometer that'll help you measure the amount of sugar in your wort so you know how strong the beer might be by the time you get done fermenting it. You need some brushes, some sanitizing solution. It's really pretty simple gear. You need a fermenter, which is either a plastic bucket or a glass, big glass jug called a carboy, and a couple of other little odds and ends, but that's about it. People do, once they get into the hobby, they start buying pH meters, and you can spend several thousand dollars on a 10 or 15-gallon system made out of stainless steel with computer control and everything like that. But most people never really find the need for that kind of extreme technology.
You do get into some fairly technical terms. I mean, will lack of attention to ions and dextrins hurt your beer?
Well, I think it's important, and that's why I start the book right out with that. A word like ion may seem kind of intimidating, but it's a pretty simple idea, really, and it's helpful to you just have to know a little bit of science in order to understand what's going on in there and to be able to make some decisions. So ions, in particular, have to do with water chemistry, which is not the most important thing in beer, but it's something that you want to pay attention to, especially in the West, where there tends to be a lot of extremely hard water or extremely soft water, neither of which are ideal for brewing most beers.
All right, so a good place to start there with the four basic ingredients. So you got water, malt, hops, and yeast. The water, if you said not the most important thing, but it certainly will make a difference. So what are some of the basic things you need to do just to make sure that the water you're starting with is a good water?
Well, you need to know what's in it. So that's the most important thing. Find out what your local water source is. Your water district is required by law to post that information. They usually send you a letter, actually, every year. But it's online available. And So then you want to just check if it's super soft water, you'll probably need to add some minerals. You need a little calcium in, because if there's not calcium, it's hard to get the enzymes in the malt to convert starches into sugar. And then if it's a really hard water, you need to kind of understand what kind of hardness it is, whether it's alkaline or acidic. And then based on what those are, you need to make some decisions relative to the type of beer you're brewing. So it's like a really geeky area, but for most brewers, you only have to do it once. You have to figure out a couple of simple things, and then you're good to go, and you don't ever really have to think about it much again.
So if you're paying any attention to detail in the process, will you generally get something not revolting?
Oh, yeah. I mean, my first beers were just disgusting. But we were operating in an era where there was very limited quality ingredients, and I'm certain that the little yeast packet that was stuck to the top of the rusty can of malt extract was not very good yeast. We didn't really understand what that was supposed to be like. So if you start right out, you'll make delicious beer. Your friends will stop bringing beer to your house ever again. So that's a little bit of a warning. Once you start homebrewing, people are like, "Well, dude, you get it like for free." So that's the one drawback of homebrewing, but it's actually a great thing. We had a guy in Chicago who brewed 10 gallons a week just to keep the band together.
Really? All kinds of ways to keep your friends happy. Randy Mosher's our guest. His book is Mastering Homebrew. Here's a call from John in Grants Pass. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Hi. When I brewed, I had trouble getting rid of the yeast, and I didn't know if you had suggestions. You know, it would obviously be in the carboy, and I tried to transfer a few times. But even when I got in the bottles, there'd always be a little tiny layer of yeast at the bottom of the bottle. And what's funny is, this is back in the I first did this, God, like you said, like back in the late 80s, and people turned up their nose. I remember my father-in-law, he drank Blitz, and that's it. He thought it was kind of funny tasting, yeasty tasting or something like that. But anyway, my real question is, how do I get rid of more yeast? Thanks.
All right, thanks,
well,
John.
Yeast, different kinds of yeast settle out more compactly or not. So there's some differences in strains. But generally, after a period of time, you just have to be a little bit patient with it. But you'll see that carboy, that beer in the carboy going from a cloudy, pale color to a much darker, more transparent color, and the beer will settle, and the yeast will all settle out on the bottom. And when you transfer that out, you use a tube where you basically are siphoning out through a hose and a little rigid tube, and you just have to be careful not to dip that tube down into the yeast layer. So you have to just be a little careful, just be a little patient. And then with bottles, you just need to pour them. If you're drinking out of the bottle, there's really nothing you can do. You need that yeast in the bottle, because if you don't have it there, it won't carbonate in the bottle and give you carb pressure. So the other thing a lot of homebrewers do after they brew a few batches is they get sick of bottling, and they go to a draft system using 5-gallon soda kegs. And once you transfer clear beer in there, pressurize it up, you'll never have any yeast out of that. So that might be a solution if you're really averse to yeast. I know some people who are actually allergic to yeast. They can drink beer, but they can't have yeast in it, so they have to be really careful. But
really?
You can definitely get rid of it. And there are some finings, they're called. There's basically a type of gelatin mix that you mix up and pour into your beer, and that will also help more quickly clarify your beer, and it'll sort of trap that solids, those yeast, and help them settle out and stick to the bottom. So you might look at using some beer finings. That'd probably be a pretty easy way to go.
You take us through a couple different ways to go about making beer, and obviously the more complicated you make it, the more varieties you can get of the beer. There's the very basic extract method, which looks almost like steeping tea. Can you walk us through that, and then we can work into complexity in some of the other versions?
Yeah, sure. It's the way everybody starts, just about, unless you're really ambitious. You buy malt extract that's either a thick syrup or a powdered form. You take a pot of water, about 3 gallons of water, put it on the stove, start heating it up. You'll have a bag of crushed ground malt that's really designed as flavoring malt to give you your flavor and color. You get the best results by using a really pale malt extract and then getting all of your flavor and color from actual grains. And that, so you put it in one of these little porous bags that you can get at the homebrew shop. You just dunk it in there like a big tea bag, and right about the time, just before the wort comes to a boil, you pull that thing out and put it in a colander on top and let it kind of all drain out back into the wort, and then you can just throw that away. And now you can start bringing it up to a boil, drop some hops in there, You may want to add hops at the beginning. You may want to add them at the end. You may even want to put hops in the middle because you're trying to get some bitterness, and that means that to get bitterness, you have to actually boil them, but that drives off aroma. So if you want aroma, you have to put them in at the end where you're not boiling away all of their beautiful aroma. So, and then at the end of that, you try and cool it down as quickly as possible. A lot of people just put it in the sink with some ice in it. There are actually some chilling devices that you can buy as part of your kit to do that. Again, different people do it different ways. But the more quickly you can chill it down, the better. Once you get it chilled down, put some yeast in there. And, you know, transfer it into your fermenter, put some yeast in there, and wait.
Randy Mosher is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His book is Mastering Homebrew, The Complete Guide to Brewing Delicious Beer. Join us on the Jefferson Exchange with comments, questions, or your own experiences with homebrew and whether or not you've mastered it. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So what's the general level of elapsed time here from you know, the basic extract process to the more complicated processes? How long between your first heating up of the stove and getting a bottle of beer?
With an extract batch of beer, you're probably in and out in somewhere between 2 and 3 hours. So it's a pretty rapid process. With all grain brewing, your minimum time's probably going to be about 5 hours. Probably for most people, it's 6 or 7. It kind of partially depends on how good you are and how experienced and how good you are at kind of keeping to a schedule. But also it has to do with how large a batch. Bigger batches just take a little time. Longer time because you've got more material to move around and heat up and cool down and so on. But and then usually for a typical beer, it's probably about 3 to 4 weeks by the time you can actually get that stuff on your lips and drink it.
You mentioned wort a couple of times, W-O-R-T, pronounced wort, which we've discussed with brewers previously. Get us back into that concept of what that is.
Unfermented beer. So it's basically mostly water with somewhere between 4% and 20% dissolved sugars and other solids. There's a little protein in there. There's some sugars that are almost a little more starchy sugars, a little longer chain sugars that don't ferment that end up giving you a little bit of sweetness and richness on the palate. Little tiny amounts of hop oils and some other things, but it's mainly sugar. So when you measure that density with a hydrometer, that gives you an idea of how much sugar you have, which is sort of an approximate knowledge of what you're going to end up with in terms of alcohol content. There's some simple ways to do that calculation.
Are these naturally occurring sugars from carbohydrates? Are these sugars you're adding?
No, well, it could be sugars you're adding, but most of when you're brewing with all malt, the sugars come from the malt. So most plants, they make seeds that have a lot of starch in them, and that functions like the yolk in an egg to support that little plant while it's in the ground and it hasn't yet developed the ability to pull in nutrients from its ingredient. So it's a little bit of a fuel source, and we just take that process and hijack it a little bit and use the plant's own enzymes that break those storage starches into sugars, and then those are sugars we're going to ferment. And with malt, it's a sugar called a maltose sugar that consists of two dextrose or grape sugars together, so it's a two-ring sugar, but that's what we want the yeast to eat.
Before we get too deep into the science, I want to pull aside and talk about just general care and feeding of your stuff. I mean, it sounds like sanitation is pretty important to the brewing process.
Yeah, cleaning and sanitation, they're somewhat different things. As somebody, some famous homebrewer once said, you cannot sanitize dirt. So you have to clean it. You need and beer has some protein in it, and the protein tends to make a little bit of a tenacious film on the sides of glass vessels and things like that. But there are some chemicals that homebrewers use that are safe to use, but they do a pretty good job of getting the dirt off. And then once you have the dirt off, then you can use a sanitizer to make sure that any little remaining bits of yeast or bacteria are killed, and then you can put your yeast in and have confidence that you're going to have a nice clean fermentation.
There's a picture of something. It's a microscopic picture of something growing on somebody's equipment. It definitely gets the point home about keeping your equipment clean.
Yeah, I put that in to scare people.
It worked. It really worked. So, Randy Mosher, which one of the components in brew would you say makes the biggest difference in taste?
Well, malt is the main element in beer, and of course that drives so much. But it does a little depend on the type of beer. If you're making an IPA, for example, and if you have a ton of hop aroma and hop bitterness, that's going to be the dominant flavor in that beer. So it's partially just the intention of the brewer and what you're trying to do. So it's either hops or malt or both of those things together. But malt gives you, because malt is a grain that is dried after the sprouting process, which is called malting, that kilning or drying process really delivers all of those familiar flavors that we know in beer. Everything from bready to cracker to biscuit to cookie to cake to caramel to nutty to toffee to roasty to chocolate to coffee. And so they taste like those ingredients because it's cooked in the same way. So the chemistry that's happening when you put a slice of bread in a toaster, it's exactly the same when the maltster is drying a malt, a middle colored malt.
So how well you cook the or kiln dry the grain is what's really going to make the difference.
That's where the flavor comes from. But that's all done by the maltster. So you have a choice as a brewer of maybe 50 different kinds of malt that you can choose from to build a recipe.
All right, now the grains involved here, I was going to ask if it's always barley, and then I turned the page and saw your reference to the dreaded rice and corn. So, tell us why barley is so much better than rice and corn.
Well, rice and corn, as they're normally used in beer, are designed to thin out the beer and lighten the body but not add a lot of flavor. But barley really is the beer ingredient that has that beery, malty taste. And it was domesticated 10,000 or 12,000 years ago for the purpose of making beer. So, it's around a long time. And it just has a nice, rich set of flavors. It has a great amount of protein in it, and that protein is really useful for making beer that has a nice body. Beer foam is all about protein. That's something that people manage when they're doing the brewing process, is make sure they have the right kind of proteins to give a good body. And, in the end, it has all these enzymes that you need to break the starches down. So it's kind of a perfect grain for brewing, because that's what early Neolithic people wanted and selected for. So, and wheat also is a great brewing ingredient. That's a very long traditional, since the very early days of beer, people have been making beer with wheat as well. It doesn't have as intense a sort of a rich malty flavor as beer, but it has a nice creaminess. So generally a wheat beer will be a really creamy beer, and people often use differing amounts of wheat in beers just to add creaminess and to help with head retention and foam in beer.
So would you ever use multiple grains in a beer, or is it pretty much you're going to choose one over the other?
Oh, no. You would definitely use multiple grains, and even in beers that are considered wheat beers, they're almost always have at least 30 or 40% barley malt in them.
Okay, so definitely a mixture there.
Yeah.
So we talked about malt, hops, water, yeast. Let's talk about the hops then. I mean, what do they do and how you prepare them for use in beer?
Well, they're not processed very heavily. Basically, they pick them out of the field and bring them in and put them in a dryer, which is a big, these huge gas-fired kilns, and they dry them very gently because they're trying to remove the moisture, but they're trying to not blow away too much of the aroma. And so once they're dried, they're compressed. Sometimes they are chopped up and put through dyes, so they come out looking a bit like rabbit food. But those are called hop pellets, and that's the most common form for them to be available to homebrewers, especially because they transport well and they're compact and they store well, and it's just easier for everybody to deal with those. But then hops are very much like wine grapes in the sense that there are a number of very distinct varieties, and they exhibit a very strong sense of terroir. So where the hops are grown, really determines a lot of the flavor of the beer or of the hops. And so you can take the famous Sots hop that's grown in Bohemia, and you can grow it. It'll grow beautifully in the Yakima Valley or Washington or up in northern Oregon in the Willamette, but they don't taste the same as they do out in the Czech Republic. So we've got hops now from all over the world. We've got a lot of newer hops coming from New Zealand and Australia. Many places in Europe that were sort of minor hop centers now are starting to become important, like France and Slovenia. So it's a really exciting time for hop varieties because there's a lot of interest in breeding new varieties that have exotic aromas like passion fruit and melon and orange and things like that. So the berry. So it's really, it's a lot of fun right now. It's one of the things that's really exciting people are these really interesting hops.
Randy, quickly before we go, what's the most common mistake, easily correctable, that'll make a bad batch of beer?
Well, I think for beginners, it's just being a little bit sloppy with sanitation, because that'll really make a bad beer. You can make poor decisions in your yeast or hops, and it won't really be a bad beer. It may not be exactly what you want, but making sure you got good, healthy yeast and a great environment. That's really the key thing.
Okay, it's a really, really exhaustive work. Mastering Homebrew, the complete guide to brewing delicious beer. Just about everything you need to know from Randy Mosher. Randy, thanks for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange.
Thanks so much, Jeff.
All right, take care.